Welcome to Tuesday Evenings at the Modern. I'm Terry Thornton. I'm Curator of Education, and I'm very proud, very happy to be a part of this program. If you have any questions about this program or any programs, please go online and check out the schedule. I've said it every week, and I'm sticking to it. I think it's proved to be true. I think this might be the best Tuesday evenings lineup in my, I think I said 17 years. I think that's about right, that I've been doing Tuesday evenings, so that's saying a lot. I know, 20 tours a year, 20 lectures a year, that's not bad. I also want to make a few announcements, if you don't mind. Remind everybody of our program, Sundays with the Modern, which is a tour program at 1 p.m. every Sunday, except for certain holidays. So again, check the schedule online. We are asking architects, artists, art scholars of all stripes to come and talk about the permanent collection, aspects of the architecture, or the special exhibition. So this Sunday, Eric Swenson, who of course is an artist with work in our collection, but he's also an artist who was at UNT during Vernon Fisher's tenure, so it should be pretty interesting. He's going to come and talk about Vernon Fisher Kmart Conceptualism, which opened last Saturday but officially opens this Sunday. So come and hear that if you can. I also want to mention the ongoing graduate student gallery presentations that happen each Tuesday at 6:15 before the lecture. They're 30 minutes long, and then they also happen on Saturday. So if you should miss one, I think every student is repeating. And again, I invite you to go online to check out the schedule for that. We're so glad to have the cafe back. This is kind of an unofficial opening tonight, but it will be open now every Tuesday as it has been in the past. I encourage you to come early for the lectures. Get your ticket so you're assured a seat. And then the galleries are open until 7, as is the cafe. Next Tuesday, we have architect William Bruder here. He's here to jury the Fort Worth AIA competition, and he will share his ideas and work in that evening's presentation, Making Architecture in Celebration of People and Places. So I invite you back next Tuesday. And then the following week, I just want to jump ahead and remind you that the artist Lawrence Wiener will be here. I have to say I'm particularly excited about that one. And I believe that Michael Opping is making special arrangements to be sure his piece is in the gallery, so I invite you to go into the galleries that week and find Lawrence's piece that has been in the past in the cafe. Tonight we are so fortunate to have art writer and curator Michelle White here to speak on the early work of artist Via Selmans. Michelle received her MA in art history from Tufts University, and she has held curatorial positions at the Museum of Fine Arts Houston, the Fogg Art Museum at Harvard University, and she comes to us tonight from Houston, where she is the associate curator at the Menil Collection, where she has organized exhibitions such as Lessons from Below, Otabenga Jones and Associates, Imaginary Spaces, Leaps into the Void, Documents of Nouveau Realist Performance, and Cy Twombly, Treaty on the Veil, which was co-curated by Bernice Rose for the Menil Drawing Institute and Study Center. And Michelle is currently in the midst of preparing for the installation of Via Selmans' Television and Disaster, 1964 to 1968, which she co-curated with Franklin Sermons, and which opens November 19th at the Menil before traveling to the Los Angeles County Museum of Art. In addition, she is currently working on Richard Serra Drawing in Retrospect, which opens at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York in 2011, travels to SF MoMA, and completes its tour at the Menil in 2012. So I have to say that I'm a little surprised that I was able to convince Michelle to come here and do this tonight in the midst of everything that she has going on, but it seems quite obvious that Michelle is not afraid of staying busy. In her somewhat short career, she has become a significant force in Texas and beyond as a frequent contributor to art papers, a regional editor of Art Lies, a lecturer of contemporary art at the Glissell School of Art in Houston, and a member of the board of directors of the Lawndale Art Center. She has many publications to her credit, including catalogs for each of the exhibitions that I've mentioned, and numerous articles. Based on all that I have read, which has been much, I have to say, especially in Art Papers and Art Lies, Michelle is a gifted writer and a passionate and informed perspective that she fearlessly and I think quite thoughtfully defends. And tonight we have the pleasure of learning more about the work of one of the modern's beloved artists from just such a perspective in Michelle's presentation via Selman's in the 1960s. So if you would, please join me in welcoming Michelle White.
Hi, thanks so much for having me here. I'm honored to be a part of this series. So I'll get right into it. Artist Via Selmans is perhaps best known for works like these. Detailed spiderwebs, meticulously crafted drawings, paintings, and prints of things like the rocky soil of the desert floor. And just a few minutes ago, we also added, let's see, this is another very typical work by Via Selmans, if you know her work. This is included, this is here at the Fort Worth Modern, and I don't know the year of it. Do you, Terry? So it's these types of works that she began to make in the 1960s, with surface textures and sometimes even a disorientating sense of space that make the work seem to spill out into infinity. And it's the type of work that she's continuing to make today. And I thought I would throw in this painting. Am I just not clicking it hard enough? This is one of her most recent works. I saw it in process in her studio this past spring, and it was included in an exhibition she just had in New York at Renee McKee Gallery, and it's one of her most recent. It's called Shell, and you can see it's a close-up image of this porous, beautiful texture of a seashell, and it's a shell that she found near her vacation home in Mexico. The topic of my talk tonight, however, is not about Via's well-known surfaces. Instead, it's about a more grisly period in Via's work. It's not as well-known, and it's a specific time period, in fact, between 1964 and 1966. And what I'm arguing is that it's this period, this short phase when Via Selmans was only in her late 20s, that really formed the conceptual grounding of her work to come. And it also serves as the exhibition that Terry mentioned that I'm organizing at the Manil Collection with Franklin Sermons at the Los Angeles County Museum of Art. And it all grew out of this idea that we were going to look at Selman's early work. And in researching and talking with the artist, we found that it was this time period that was fascinating and often overlooked within a larger conversation in art history. And I will, since the dates are up right now, the opening night is November 18th. It's a Thursday, and the public's welcome. Via's going to be in attendance. And also the next night, on the 19th, which is a Friday, I'll be doing a public conversation with Via. So please come if you'd like a trip to Houston. So it was during this period that she was making works like these. And she was exploring themes of death and disaster. So these are two works in the exhibition, which will only consist of about 18 paintings and sculptures. So you can see on the left, it's a man on fire running from the wreckage of a car. And on the right is forest fire. And the painting on the right actually has been in Via's studio since she believes it has never been shown, according to Via, but sometimes I'm not quite sure if she remembers, but we're thrilled to have it. It's just been restretched, and which, you know, it's the great thing about working with an artist. And she, too, hasn't really reflected that much on this specific time period, so it's been a treat to have these conversations and then to do this show. And so other works from this time period that I'll show involve other themes related to death and disasters. They include crashing airplanes, urban riots, and other images that she primarily derives from the mass media, from magazines, as well as images that she would covertly tear out of library books. This is how she explains it, that she couldn't buy the books, so she'd go to the public library and covertly tear them out. So what I'd like to argue, and the framework, the curatorial framework that we've established for this show, as well as the essay I've written for the catalog, and for which this talk is based, has to do with what makes this work from this time period, when the artist was only in her late 20s, so special and so unique. And in doing this research and talking to the artist, one of the most compelling reasons that we found has to do with what it means when we place V.S. Selman's work from this time period within a larger art historical conversation. Specifically, the historical, political, and geographical context that she was working in when she was making these works, and that was Los Angeles. And Los Angeles is where she initially moved to after she graduated from the Heron Art Institute in Indianapolis, and she came to Los Angeles in 1962 to attend graduate school at UCLA in painting. So when V.S. Selman's arrived to Los Angeles, this was a really unique moment and a really specific moment. That summer, when she lands in the city, Andy Warhol has just debuted his Silkscreen Soup Cans. It's in what has many consider Andy Warhol's first exhibition. And for many, this marks the significant shift away from the generation of abstract expressionist painters before her. And that was how she was trained as a young artist, in this abstract expressionist style. And it was among many events in this time, along with the Ferris Gallery show and Andy Warhol making his debut. There were other shows of artists like this featuring work where artists were turning to the real or common or everyday object to make comments about the banality of modern consumer society. And significantly, it was these artists, they weren't looking inside, like Jackson Pollock was looking inside to express himself. They were looking outside to the street itself. And it was a shift that was explored in an important exhibition that also came to Los Angeles the next summer. It was a show organized by the Guggenheim Museum, and it was called Six Painters and the Object. And it's yet another example of the heightened presence of pop art in the city at this time that was really seeping into the psyche of California artists. Included in that exhibition, for example, was Jasper John's Flag. And if anybody knows, I don't think it was this particular flag included in the show, but it's something I haven't been able to find. You know, as goes the well-known interpretation of this work, you know, while it's a representation or sign of a patriotic piece of cloth, through the artist's straightforward presentation, it also is a flag. That is to say, while it's not made of a piece of fabric per the object's traditional definition, Johns has rendered it in a way that the painting carries as much weight as the actual object, as the symbolic weight of the flag. And this is that brilliant collapse of the space between art and life. And it's this intentionally, we could say, confusing semantic dance between the sign and the signified that also emblematizes the type of elastic back and forth with the idea of representation itself that was informing Los Angeles art at the time and pop artists in Los Angeles as they were sort of negotiating what this language was meaning, especially as it was coming from New York City specifically. And they were invested in trying to figure out a way to make that language of pop art their own. And this is when V.S. Selman's is coming to age as a young artist. And it's in such this really fertile intellectual moment that the types of questions her early work is going to ask will bring forth this really complex relationship of form and content, which I believe really sort of forms the crux of her work and what really reveals the strength of V.S. Selman's as an artist, especially within the wider lens of painting in the 1960s. So to provide you a little bit more of a background in Los Angeles at the time, Artists, we could say, were influenced by a changing city of freeways, the movie industry, sunshine and sunsets. It was a look established and even given a title or referred to as the cool school. And that was a term defined in an essay by Philip Leader in Art Forum magazine in 1964. And in California, Leader wrote, artists such as Ed Ruscha, Larry Bell, Joe Good, were much like their New York counterparts, looking for a way to critique everyday life, advertising, consumer society, and doing so by adopting that slick language of the form itself of advertising and mass media. The California artists, however, Leader argued, were doing something different. They were responding with this cooler look that was subtler and less boisterous, and even more economical. California pop, Leader argued, was based on, quote, a hatred of the superfluous, a drive towards compression, and a precision of execution. Another example of this kind of understanding of the cool school aesthetic, especially that kind of precision of execution and that less boisterous feel, would be Joe Good's milk bottle paintings from the early 1960s. And this is one in the collection of the Museum of Contemporary Art in San Diego. And I like it because you'll see it very much seems to inform V.S. Selman's isolated objects that are about to come. And in these works, basically, he would take a regular Altadena dairy milk bottle, glass bottle, paint it, and set it in front on a shelf or on the floor in front of a muted monochrome canvas. And we can think about this in distinction to, say, Andy Warhol's soup cans or even his, soda bottles. With these, there's a certain sense, or there's a certain lack of irony, I'd say. It's less boisterous. This is this cool seclusion that Philip Leader was talking about in Art Forum magazine. So beginning in 1962, V.S. Selmans was also painting common objects, and she was painting them with that detached austerity and meticulousness of process that very much fit this cool school aesthetic. She was turning to these very functional and quotidian objects as opposed to decorative that she was seeing in her studio. So in addition to this hot plate, she was painting things like mugs of steaming coffee, frying eggs, coffee, portable electric fans. She would paint them life-size, and she'd place them on very muted muted backdrops of gray or beige. Okay, this is from my cell phone, so I apologize for the bad quality, but it actually looks pretty good. That's Via, and she doesn't know I took this picture. So this is in her studio. We were going through these boxes, and I like this picture because they're a reproduction of her previous paintings, these common object paintings, and she doesn't know where a lot of them are, and a lot of them have been lost, so it was kind of thrilling to see them in reproduction together. And if anybody knows, see, it looks like a kettle. She did these series of fish on plates around the same time, and does anybody know what, I cannot figure out what this is. Is it some type of radio? Does anybody know? Butter? Here? Really? What do you think those two little dots are? Interesting. Okay, a plate of butter. Thank you. So this gives you a sense of the other types of common object painting she was making around this time. And what's so interesting about these works, I think, is that she kind of makes them into this very hard-to-define emotional content. In many ways, they act like lonely statements of fact. For example, let's go to another work. This is also from the same time period. It's also an object that was in her studio that she painted life-size. And in fact, I should say in her master's show, which was in 1964 at UCLA, She actually made painted objects on canvas and put them on wood frames, so they became the actual objects in place. And none of them exist. She also would cut them out. She did a banana peel and cut it out and put it on the wall. So this painting is Heater. It's in the collection of the Whitney Museum of Art, and it was most recently exhibited this spring for the Whitney Collect show, if anybody saw it. So what it is basically a glowing portable appliance, and it sits firmly in the middle of the canvas. The cord extends to the left as if it's plugged in. And there's also, you can see kind of light modeling and shading evident at the base. Yet there's little else to indicate a discernible place. There's no clues to figure out where it is. We don't know where the heater's location could be. And that's this kind of hard-to-determine emotional content that I think is so interesting about this work. And moreover, in addition to this ambiguous backdrop, Selman's techniques, too, are based on these reductive, pragmatic decisions that seem to be about as utilitarian as the objects she's painting. And I think as a result of this, you know, the artist's very nuanced play with formal details, like this placeless palette, creates a really disconcerting atmosphere. And it seems to freeze, even that fiery center of the heater, as if it's wrapped in this chilly stillness. And interestingly, in the first published review of V.S. Selman's work from 1964, the reviewer said that, be careful, V.S.'s work will keep you at arm's length. So when V.S. Selman's moved to Los Angeles for graduate school, her ambition was to do just as the critic described. She wanted to purge the surface of her work and remove that diaristic subjectivity that had defined the action painting of artists like Jackson Pollock a generation before her. For her, art came to be about the cold, hard facts. And I'll quickly pause, since we're in V.S. Selman's move to Los Angeles in the 60s. The top image is of her studio. She had a studio on Venice Boulevard that she described as big and bright, and it's also where she lived. And it looks like there's one of the paintings of the plane in process right here. And the picture on the bottom is Via in the process of making the first painting that I showed of the Burning Man. And so going back to Via's sort of take on how she was thinking about process, she said at this time, quote, "I decided to go back to looking at something outside of myself. I was going back to what I thought was this basic, stupid painting. There's the surface. There's me. There's my hand. There's my eye. I paint. I don't embellish anymore. I don't compose. I don't jazz up the color." So really avoiding any thought of contrived composition, Selman's was approaching her work with a sober restraint that was consciously modest. She was rejecting, again, that bombastic and subjective way of making that had defined the generation of artists before her. And in fact, when I asked the artists, and something I've always been intrigued by her work is how she explains her method of applying the paint. And she told me even the way in which she first chose to apply the paint, and I should mention the way she begins painting in the 1960s is what defines the way she's painting today, was about this desire to find a way to paint that resists the past. In fact, she tries not to even have a technique or she doesn't articulate it as having a technique, which is interesting. And she said to me, quote, "I try to paint softly, without making any gesture, without any theater, without making my stroke something that would be mine." And if we go back to the heater and think about this, it's this, what I found in thinking about this work is what's so fascinating then about this very cerebral, very cool approach to making is how art history has not positioned it within that conversation about the cool school. And in looking for explanations, it's interesting to me to find that It was Lucy Lepard who included Via Salmons in her very early chronicle of pop art in 1964, so right when Via is starting to make these works. She's included in this publication that really defines what pop art is about. And there was a chapter on California pop. And in this text, she very much suggests that Salmon's paintings from this time of aloof and menacing ordinary objects, with their hot coils, with their steam, with their electricity, are comforting, if not humorous. And I'll read the quote from the text because I think it's really fascinating. She writes, "Via Salmons does realistically describe portraits of isolated smoking objects, a just-fired pistol, steaming matzo balls and chicken soup, cooking eggs, and a selection of turned-on appliances. The isolation of objects against empty background makes for comedy. In this instance, rather than surrealist effects, most are warmly domestic pictures. And even the pistol has a fireside coziness about it." So this interpretation was so fascinating to me, and it prompts the question, right? Do Salmon's paintings truly convey this homey and even feminine sense of retreat? Or do they capture that cool, again, detached austerity that critics would have read in the work of her male colleagues at this time as a really smart allegory of painting itself in the state of representation in the 1960s? And that's the argument that essentially I'm trying to make. To be sure, Salmon's work does not categorically conform to the tenets of any movement. And she herself does not believe that her work kind of fits what she called this LA look. She was friends with a lot of California artists of the time. She was good friends with James Turrell, Douglas Wheeler, Robert Irwin. But she believed that what she was making was quite different and that she was isolated from her peers. Moreover, to think about Salmon's place in the larger history of art, it's also been undefined as a result of her emergence in this very transitional moment of art making, painting specifically. I mean, the decision to paint like this in such a representational style in this moment of time could very much seem anachronistic. And it's for this reason been easy for many writers to kind of situate her in this placeless category, instead of putting her within the conceptual significance of the conversations that were taking place at this time. One example is Dave Hickey, how he's understood Via Salmon's process or Via Salmon's work at this time. And he wrote that her work has, quote, a kind of stateless foreign accent. So what I'm arguing, again, is quite different. I think we really greatly diminish the power of her work if we remove it from this discourse, remove it from what else was happening at this time. For it's this context that's especially important to Salmon's paintings made between 1964 and 1966, especially those that are defined by more violent imagery. So in 1964, so she had started making these common object paintings in 1962, and in 1964, here's the shift. She begins by making these pistol paintings. And this is a whole series. There's about four paintings that exist of a hand holding a gun. And with these, she begins incorporating found images of violence from television and the media. And it's also, this shift has also been attributed to the way she changes the way of working. Instead of looking again at that real object, the real object sitting on the floor of her studio, she began to use her own snapshots and collected images that she pulls from magazines and clips from books. It's these tangible representations that you can hold in your hand. Oops. Okay. I just jumped the gun there. And she says that she likes to collect images that she can sort through like playing cards. And here's another one of my cell phone images. But what I loved is that she has these drawers in her studio, and they're just filled with images. And you can see, she has a stack of the star images. She also takes pictures of her work and thinks about them even more through this kind of these fragments that are almost like objects that she uses as inspiration. And here, I just I did a close-up of this one. This is Via, probably in the late 1960s. She didn't remember what date exactly, but this would have placed her in her late 20s, so around 64, 65. And that's her, too. So you can see this is a source image for the gun painting that she used to make the work. That was also in her piles of images in her studio. So of this series, basically it's a cropped forearm that emerges from one side of the canvas. And it's that fragment that I mentioned that's used as a source. And according to the artist, this is the story, that apparently a friend who was moving away gave her a gun. She didn't really know what to do with it. It was sitting on her floor, and much like those common objects when she was looking for inspiration around her, she decided to ask a friend to hold it so she could take a picture to base a new series of work on. And she said she was intrigued by the power of this thing. And here's another variation. This is in the collection of the Museum of Modern Art. So as in her previous work, Selmans has again made these reductive formal decisions. We have the same placeless background and that alluring cloak of this kind of pallid neutral hue. And again, the subject is rendered life-size, and she's applied the paint with that careful and soft but impersonal touch. But what's different here and what's different in this break from those common objects is how the form complicates the subject matter. And we could say because it's sort of kind of wrapped in that hushed haze of what's now become her characteristic mode of rendition,